The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, with a few exceptions, J1 Match Day 5 wasn't as action-packed as some of the earlier rounds, but we still had the comedy officiating and calamitous own goals we've come to expect so far this season.
Oh yeah, this season's been absolutely defined by that, hasn't it? Some of the own goals, I mean, we've got a real own goal of the month competition. I remember Stuart Woodward in the Patreon-only line group suggested that after the WADA one. I thought, okay, that's sewn up. But yeah, there's lots of contenders so far this year.
Yeah, remarkable, and it just keeps on producing week after week. Yes, the own goal meter is clicking along at a very rapid rate. All right, so yes, eager-eared listeners will remember that in recent podcasts we've been leading off our episodes by talking about teams winning for the first time in this new season, but that was not the case for any teams on either Saturday or Sunday. So let's lead off this episode, Sam, by talking about the two teams that have both racked up three-game winning streaks after match day five. And we also saw the last unbeaten record fall in the first game that we're going to chat about, as Urawa hosted Niigata at Komaba, which has again proved to be a very happy hunting ground for Reds this season. They have obviously got the first win of the new campaign against Cerezo Osaka there back in match day three, and they played at their spiritual home for the second and final time this season. And yeah, they made the most of it against visiting Albert X, having to come from behind, Sam, before ultimately sending the punters their home happy with a 2-1 victory.
It was looking like more of the same from Niigata after they took the lead. They started really well, maybe got a little bit lucky in the way that the ball fell to Ota. But yeah, he's taken to this league fantastically. It was a great touch for him, set himself up and volleyed it straight over Nishikawa, and very little he could do about it. It was a fantastic start. And yeah, you thought maybe this is another game that Niigata are going to do well in, another scalp they're going to take. But you got to give a lot of credit to Reds. I think they came back really well. For the rest of the game, I thought defensively they were very, very solid. They're not flashy going forward by any means, but they were effective in this game. They took advantage of some weaknesses at the back for Niigata, especially in dealing with crosses. And yeah, they were fully deserving of the 3 points.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, so you've mentioned that Niigata got off to a very fast start with Shusuke Ota scoring his third top flight goal of the season in just the 10th minute. And yes, Niigata picking up from where they had left off in the last couple of match days. But as Sam said, yes, Reds grew into the game at a very wet and wild Komaba Stadium. And 10 minutes before the break, they drew level after a bit of a scramble in the Niigata box. The Albert X defense were unable to clear, and Urawa captain Hiroki Sakai fired home from the edge of the box at Ryosuke Kojima's near post. And it got even better for the hosts in first half stoppage time after Alex Schultz's header on target was hacked out for a corner from the resulting set piece. Michael Fitzgerald headed inadvertently the ball back across the box where Takahiro Akimoto was waiting to unleash a terrific leaping volley into the net from inside the 6-yard box. A very pleasing response for the Reds faithful there at their side, as you say, Sam, bouncing back from that adversity of going behind so early. And as we said, I think last week, it's the Schultz and Hoybraten coming out party. But overall, this just seemed like a really controlled and composed team effort from Reds on Saturday.
Yeah, it was. They were very much in control, I thought, for large parts of the game. Especially, we've seen how well that Ito has played when he's getting into space, and Mito and Ota as well. And I thought, defensively, they really shepherded all of those. So they couldn't really get out as much as usual, Niigata. I thought Iwao and Ito, especially in midfield, were very good, very diligent in their work. And the defensive pairing, it looks very, very solid already. And going forward, again, as I said, it wasn't flashy, but they just kept peppering the box with crosses. And Niigata really couldn't deal with it. Michael Fitzgerald had a difficult game in trying to clear the ball. Everything he did was skied upwards or not very far outside of his area. And that led to the two goals and various other chances throughout the game, actually. So, yeah, it was a really solid enough performance from Reds. They kind of went back to a maybe more basic. They took Moberg out of the team and they were had Sekine on that right hand side, a better maybe deliverer of the ball as Moberg kind of wants to cut inside. And they took advantage of, yes, a weakness there at the back for Niigata. They were maybe missing three of their probably starting defenders, if you're thinking of Korigome, Chiba and Fujiwara, who probably would have started. And yeah, they kind of suffered for that. It just wasn't a controlled defensive performance. Kojima bailed them out on a couple of occasions, but yeah, it wasn't really enough.
Right, and yeah, so Reds is a 2-1 lead, obviously held throughout the remainder of the game, the entire second half, but there was a bit of a hearts-in-mouths moment for the Reds supporters in the 92nd minute when Niigata's other man of the moment, Ryotaro Ito, stood over a free kick 20 yards out. He aimed for Nishikawa's far top corner, but to the relief of the home supporters, and of course Nishikawa himself, it didn't quite have enough curl and dip on it and missed narrowly high and wide. So yes, a first defeat of the season for Niigata, as Sam said, slightly short of numbers at the back or of their regular starters anyway. But yeah, Reds, a very positive couple of weeks has been for them. Three straight wins over Cerezo, Kobe and Niigata. And as I said, they've played for the second and final time at Komaba. So they leave there with some happy memories of their two home games this season. They return to home action at Saitama Stadium, finally in match day 8 for the visit of Sapporo. So yes, whether Reds are able to schedule a couple games per season at Komaba going forward, I'm sure their supporters really enjoy the change of scenery and atmosphere. As we've said, it is their spiritual home, in inverted commas, and they've done particularly well there in their two games at that ground this season. But for Niigata then, Sam, as we wrap up this game, a first defeat. It was obviously bound to happen sooner or later, and I'm sure this won't take too much gloss off of what has been a truly tremendous start to their return to J1.
No, it shouldn't do. This is just one of those games where the opposition played really well defensively and nullified their threats. And yeah, a couple of players missing. Add to that Takahiro Ko in midfield, who I think is so good at that link-up play. And I think without him there, it just broke down a little bit more than it has done. They've been so free-flowing in the way they've been able to counter-attack teams and even control games throughout this season so far. But Reds were wise to it. They defended really well. So you've just got to say, if you Niigata, yeah, fair play. We were beaten by a team that played really well. So yeah, they won't complain. They won't be too upset about this. They'll know that they can go on and beat other teams going forward. And yeah, first defeat. And they've had a really good start to the season. So yeah, no concerns after one defeat.
No worries then for Niigata. And yeah, the good times rolling at Urawa, as we said, on the back of three straight wins and also notching a third straight triumph on Saturday were Kyoto. Yes, can you believe it? Sanga continuing to throw egg in the face of Sam, myself and Johnny after we all tipped them to finish bottom in our J-Preds. And they continued their purple patch, no pun intended, by heading up to Kanagawa for the second straight week and following up last weekend's win over Shonan by sweeping aside bottom club Yokohama FC 4-1. I mentioned to Manny Padovan on Twitter at the end of last week, I fancied Yokohama FC in this one, Sam. I walked the walk as well as talking the talk. I put Koki Ogawa into my J-League fantasy team, and after 12 minutes, I was feeling pretty good about things after Ogawa rose in the centre to glance home a terrific header from Tatsuya Hasegawa's cross in from the left. But once Patrick stooped to head home a Shinpei Fukuoka corner from just inside the penalty spot in the 34th minute, Kyoto were rampant.
They were. I thought first half, or at least until it was 1-1, it was a really open game end to end. The conditions were quite terrible, but it was adding to a really exciting game. Not necessarily one full of quality, but yeah, really action packed. And Yokohama started really well. I think they had a shot inside about 30 seconds that Wagahara kind of tipped over, but kind of skidded off his fingertips. But yeah, they looked pretty decent. They were full value for their lead, I thought, at 1-0 when Ogawa scored. But yeah, Kyoto just got into it, and the more they put pressure on that Yokohama defence, the more they buckled. And then, yeah, 1-1 going into half-time, and then it all fell apart in the second half. The defending is really poor. I mean, there are two goals in this game. The first one you mentioned there with Patrick, it's a stooping header from a corner. It should not be allowed to get to waist height on the six-yard box. It has to be cut out. It just wasn't. And time and time again, they were just out, done in by balls, set pieces into their area, Yokohama FC. It was really poor. And then the implosion in the second half is, yeah, it was devastating for them, because I picked this game out last week. I thought this was a really massive game for Yokohama FC. If they are to stay in this division, games like these have to be won. And to lose one to Kyoto 4-1 at home is just, it was an embarrassing result. There's no other way to describe it.
Yeah, a really disappointing second half, especially from Yokohama FC. As Sam said, in testing conditions before a very low crowd of under 3,500. Of course, there's not a lot of cover from the elements at Mitsuzawa. And, the heavy rain on Saturday obviously deterred any neutrals or undecideds who were thinking about going along or not. And Patrick's strike partner Kosuke Kinoshita netted for the second straight game when his deflected shot at the end of an end-to-end counter-attack flashed past Kengo Nagai 3 minutes after the break. Then Patrick's replacement, Ryogo Yamasaki, headed in a corner with 20 minutes left to make the point safe. The icing on the cake coming by via a Boniface Induka own goal from another Sanga set piece 10 minutes from time. So, Sam, I don't know if this is too early or not. We're probably still in overreaction theatre territory, but are Kyoto this year's version of 2022 Kashiwa Reysol, an unfancy team most tipped to struggle? But three straight wins have taken them up to fifth after match day five.
Oh, goodness me, putting me on the spot there. I don't think so. I still think there are issues in this team. I think that was seen at the start of this game. They're quite easy to get at defensively, but they have started well. They've got points on the board, which is fantastic for them. They're scoring goals. They've got a lot of players in form at the right time or at the same time, which was the concern. Like, maybe you might get a good purple patch out of Patrick at one stage, but it needs to coincide with others. And at the moment, it is. They found a decent formula going forward. But yeah, I think just a win against Yokohama FC, I think it's easy to overreact to this, because I think Yokohama have just been so poor. But it's perfect for Sanga. They've started so well. They've got themselves into a position where, especially with only one team going down, and that's their main focus at the moment, they're already 8 points from the drop zone, which is a fantastic position to be in. And it should allow them to be free. It should allow teams that get off to this start, and we'll come on to Fukuoka as well. I don't imagine they'll necessarily play with freedom for Fukuoka, but it is an opportunity for those sorts of teams to do that, like having this cushion that they do. So maybe they can go on, but I think that Reysol team last year had a little bit more in terms of creativity and goals in them, and I don't necessarily think Sanga is scoring four every week. I think this is the first time they scored more than two this season and last season, and I don't imagine it to be a regular thing, but it'd be great for them if they are, and I very much hope for them that they is. But I think, yeah, I'm not going to get too carried away about this result especially.
No, fair enough then. But up to the giddy heights of fifth, as we mentioned, and on the back of three straight wins, Yokohama FC remain rooted to the foot of the table with just a point from their five games. And I think we've said it so far pretty much every week, Sam. They've had good periods in matches, but overall they're really struggling to, obviously it goes without saying, they haven't won yet, to put 90 minutes together, even 60 minutes of extended positive football. So obviously a long way to go, and they're a long way from being cut adrift yet. There are obviously two other teams that are yet to win this season as well. But I think the warning signs are starting to flash pretty brightly, aren't they?
Yeah, it's not looking good. 13 goals conceded in 5 games is not good enough. And no matter how much you and how many much of pressure you can put on the opposition, if it is so easy to score against them, I think they're going to struggle to win many games. I think Ogawa, that's the one positive. Ogawa, after that first game where I wasn't particularly delighted with him, I didn't think he played that well. After that, he has looked a threat, and he's been a threat against every defence since then. So they've got that positive, but it's just, are they going to create enough chances for him that are going to counterbalance the goals that they're definitely going to concede? Because, yeah, they've not had Brodersen for all season. I think he's dealing with injuries. That defence is not going to get any better just with the players that they've got, because with Gabriel out for the season, I think the rest of them, they have looked poor. And you imagine that whatever's behind them is not as good, it's obviously not as good as what they're trying to play. So, yeah, Iwatake and Unduka do not leave me with any confidence in them. And I think I picked him out at the start of the season, but Yuri Lima, he seems to be getting overrun in midfield as well. He's not necessarily providing the cover that he was expected to. So, yeah, it's difficult to really be too positive about them, but I think they just need to go for it and just try and win games 4-3. I think that's what we were hoping for at the start of the season. And at the moment, yeah, they've not quite been able to provide Ogawa with enough chances to overcome, yeah, their massive defensive frailties.
All right then. So a lot of work to do over the international break for Yokohama FC. They will return after the break by hosting Fukuoka. And speaking of Avispa, well, yeah, we said Kyoto are flying high in fifth. How about Avispa? They are now up into fourth after they were at it again, Sam, on Sunday. One of the two matches played on Sunday, smash and grabbing at home. This time it was over Shonan after a largely uneventful first half in which Shuto Machino's goal was chalked off when the linesman said the ball had crossed the line before Kosuke Onose crossed. Belmari's bad luck continued after the break. Machino's 50th minute goal correctly disallowed for offside. Then the Belmari striker won a penalty shortly after, only for VAR to overturn the decision due to an offside in the build-up. But the visitors did finally take the lead in the 73rd minute when Kosuke Onose controlled a chipped ball in from Taiyo Hiraoka and lashed high into the net at Takumi Nagaishi's near post. So we'll go on to the drama of second half stoppage time shortly, Sam. But up to this point, with about 15 minutes to go in this game, I don't think any Avispa supporters could complain that this wasn't a deserved lead for Shonan.
No, they were much the better side. They were kind of getting a receipt for their VAR luck, if you want, in the first game against Sagan Tosu, where everything went for Shonan in that game. Here, everything went against them. They were all correct decisions, but the margins on each of them were really, really tight. So very unfortunate the way it was, but they were the better team. They were creating the chances. I thought the goal they scored was really nice. Hiraoka, the lovely cutback and the ball over the top. Onose, who I think has played very well for Shonan this season. It was a good touch and finish from him. And yeah, at that point, they looked very comfortable. Avispa had not really created anything going forward. Shonan looked solid there. It looked like if anyone was going to score the next goal, it was going to be them. So yeah, for the events to transpire the way they did afterwards is a crushing blow for Shonan, who must have thought they had this game wrapped up.
Indeed, indeed. So I've got to hold my hands up here, Sam. I didn't even realise that Wellington was back in the J-League. But then, yeah, there he was on the highlights after the Fukuoka manager Shigetoshi Hasebe threw him on with about 20 minutes to go. So, yes, Wellington now in his second stint with Avispa, having left Shonan for the second time at the end of last season. And he played a role in his new/old side, equalising in the 6 minute of stoppage time. He headed on a long ball forward, and Yuya Yamagishi volleyed in a tremendous shot to make it 1-1. But he wasn't finished yet, and Yamagishi won it in stunning style in the 99th minute, first timing a sublime strike past Song Boom-kyun from the edge of the box with the last kick of the game after good work down the right by Reiju Tsuruno. So, yeah, absolute heartbreak for Shonan, but a massive 3 points for Fukuoka to take them, yes, up to the giddy heights of fourth, Sam.
Yeah, massive. And I think Wellington's already got an agreement to join Kobe at the end of the season to complete that trilogy. But yeah, you bring him on, he's not necessarily pretty, but he's effective. You just lump the ball up to him, he's going to cause problems. Song had to make one save from him, and then, yeah, heavily involved in that first goal for Yamagishi, just nodding it down. He's very difficult for any defender in the J-League to deal with, and it was knocked down, and it's such a good finish, the first one from Yamagishi. Ball just dropped through him on the swivel, first time into the top corner, and the second goal is just as good. Good work from the youngster, Cyrano, on that right-hand side, passed it back. Another lovely first time effort from Yamagishi, who has not really got off to that great a start this season compared to what he was doing last year, but this was a great way to announce himself for this season. A fantastic pair of goals, and yeah, Shonan absolutely shell-shocked.
Yeah, most definitely. So, yeah, Bel Murray, with just the one win to show for their exertions this season. Of course, that romp away at Tosu on their other trip to Kyushu this season back in match day one. But, yes, they've returned back to Hiratsuka with their tails between their legs after this late show from Yuya Yamagishi. And, well, Sam, I'm pretty sure I know the answer to this. I don't think Fukuoka are this year's version of Kashiwa Reysol, are they?
No, I don't think so. They're definitely smash and grab. I think if you look at any metric of this game and a lot of the games that Avispa play, they should be losing them. They should have lost this game, absolutely. But Shonan didn't take their chances, and Avispa managed to hang in. They're decent enough defensively that they are able to do this, and they've got weapons like Wellington that you can bring off the bench, and it's not going to be pretty. It's not going to be easy on the eye, but they've proven to be effective. So, yeah, fair play, I suppose, for Avispa. I'm not sure how long they can continue playing games like this and being outplayed in them for the vast majority of it and still coming away with a victory. But, yeah, as with Kyoto, these are such vital points at the start of the season, especially, as I said, with the one relegation place. You know, just to get this sort of lead already, it almost puts you with one foot safe into next season. And that it could free them up to be a little bit more expressive. But, yeah, they're main aim is just to stay in the division, and the way it's going so far has been absolutely perfect for them.
Yeah, I guess if you factor in a normal season with the three teams that getting relegated, then yeah, you kind of target your target point total in an 18 team league is between 35 and 40, isn't it? But yeah, the worst team will probably struggle to get 30. So if you look at it like that, Fukuoka already a third of the way to what would be a par score in terms of safety. 10 points on the board after five games, after a four game unbeaten run is good going in anybody's books. And yes, they've ridden their luck in a number of those victories, but yeah, fair dues to them. They kept on going right until the end. They didn't give up against Bel Murray, and yet Yamagishi's magic has won it for them. All right, then. So that rounds out part one of this episode then. Three straight wins for Urawa and Kyoto, and Fukuoka making it four unbeaten with that home win over Shonan. We'll take a very quick break, and then we'll come back with some more of the games from match day five. Welcome back. Next, let's cover the other game played on Sunday. It came at the Edeon Stadium in Hiroshima. And I think the best way to describe this game is complete one-way traffic when Sanfrecce hosted Kashiwa Reysol. It did take until the last 10 minutes for Hiroshima's pressure to finally bear fruit, and it did via a deflected Tsukasa Shiotani strike. But again, there was only ever going to be one winner in this game. And yes, to the relief of the home fans at the Edeon Stadium, Sanfrecce were finally able to break Reysol down.
Yeah, they took their time. They had plenty of chances. And to be fair to Morita in the Reysol goal, he made a number of good saves, but I thought they were also quite wasteful with their finishing as well. Hiroshima, I think Shichi had a few. Higashi blazed over a couple of times. Kawamura, who I don't know what's happened to him this season, but he can't hit a barn door at the moment. And when he does, so it's not allowed. They just struggled. Ben Khalifa, not really that great with his finishing either. It was all quite easy for the Reysol goalkeeper. But eventually they managed to keep pressing, and eventually found the way through. I thought Midstone finally got back into a central position again. He was playing right wing back, which allows a lot more attacking players onto the pitch, but it's not him in his right position. I think he's much better centrally, and he proved that way. And eventually they broke them down. It's a little bit of good fortune, which they haven't necessarily had this season, but it was a thoroughly deserved victory. It was one-way traffic. Reysol made a few changes defensively. They brought back Tanaka, who had been away with the under-20s over in Uzbekistan. They played Sushir also at the back, dropping Kawaguchi and Tatsuta, which I think was necessary. But then in attack, anyone that had any sort of like flair was dropped. Koyamatsu wasn't there. Mateo Savio wasn't there. Sento wasn't there. So there wasn't a great deal of creativity. They went with the new signing, J-Roy Grote, up front, and he had a horrible day up against Hayato Araki, who absolutely dominated him. It's a shame he didn't do it maybe a week earlier and maybe got himself into the Japan team on the basis of that, but I thought he was fantastic. So Hiroshima were under no threat going one way, and it was just a matter of time before they took the lead. It was a 1-0 battering.
Yeah, indeed. I certainly gather that from the highlights. And you mentioned Mitsuta there. He played a huge part in the winner, kind of dribbling into a cul-de-sac before retreating and passing back to Shiotani, who cut back onto his left foot and a shot from 25 yards in the 82nd minute, the ball deflecting off Reysol defender Takumi Tsuchiya and just creeping inside Tatsuya Morita's left-hand post. So it's something that Johnny mentioned in last week's episode, Sam, and you've mentioned it again there, the need for Skibber, to try and get as many of his creative slash attacking players onto the pitch as possible. But do you feel he's I think it clearly is doing it at the he's detracting from the best that Mitsuta can offer to his team until he's able to bring somebody on at right wing back, or he shifts the formation to get Mitsuta back into a more central, a more attacking area of the pitch later on in the game. So would appear to me that that's something that he might have to move on from and just play Mitsuta where he's best suited and find somebody else to play either right back or right wing back, because Johnny mentioned his lack of defensive now. And he just seems to be taking quite a bit away from one of his key attacking weapons.
Yeah, I don't really get it, to be honest, because I think maybe he's of those players. If you're looking at Morishima, Kawamura, and Mitsuta, maybe he's the best at going out there, and that's maybe why he is in that position. But I think he's also the best in the number 10 position. I think it offers so much more with him there. I don't think Kawamura is playing well enough to move Mitsuta out of that position. So yeah, I would absolutely be going right with the right wing back. You've got Nakano, who's pretty decent. I think maybe their issue is that Kashua hasn't been fit, and maybe they would have preferred him to play in that role, and Chajima also has not been fit, so maybe they're not quite maybe he's not quite set on Nakano in terms of an attacking force from that right wing back position, so that maybe that's his issue. But I think it's really taking away from what Mitsuta can do, because as soon as he moved into that attacking position, I think he forced one very good save from Marjo, obviously heavily involved in the goal, and it just shows it was just such an increase into the danger that Hiroshima would pose Kashua. So I think he really needs to move away from it. Maybe he's waiting for the right player to play there, and maybe they can get into fitness over this international break. But yeah, I think defensively he's not very good, and I think that caused problems last week. Obviously, he didn't have to do a great deal in this game. But yeah, I think it's the thing, you need your best players in their best position, and Mitsuta and Morishima in behind the striker, I think, is absolutely the way Hiroshima should be playing.
Right. And we mentioned a couple of candidates to be this year's version of 2022 Kashua Reysol in part one, Sam. This incarnation of Kashua Reysol would love to be the 2022 version of their own club, wouldn't they? Because they are really, really struggling. And maybe most of us jumped the gun a season too early on the demise of Kashua, because I think, at the start of last season, we were probably expecting this kind of a return. They obviously proved us all wrong last year, but they're certainly finding 2022 to be a hard act to follow.
Yeah, they're just not very good. I didn't think they looked that good going into last season, but they found lightning in a bottle for a long part of that season and did really well. And defensively, they were a lot better than they were this season. I said it in the preview, to lose Takahashi, Kamijima and Ominami and then barely replace them. They did with Diego, who's then been injured for the entire time. And then Shimizu defenders, which was a strange decision. But they just look really, really poor at the back. It's so easy for anyone to get at them. And then he's not helping himself, I don't think, with the changes he's made. Why would you take all your creativity away? I don't know what that was about, because Hiroshima are very competent at dealing with long balls up front. Their back three is as good as anyone's, and it was so easy to for the Araki especially to deal with all the balls launched up to Grote and Hosoya, who had absolutely no joy in this game. And it's not really working. I can understand why he made change, because those creative players, to be fair, have not been great in the last few games. We mentioned how few chances they've created in their previous game. So, yeah, if they're not getting anything out of their attack, they certainly haven't got a defence to rely on. It's looking, I wouldn't say worrying, because they've still got Yokohama FC in the league, and I think a lot of teams will look at that as a bit of a solace at the moment. But, it's nothing's coming together for them. I just don't see a real cohesion between the team. And, it's just maybe when Grote gets up to fitness, it adds a new dynamic to their attack. But, this was a really poor display.
Indeed, yes. The league's lowest scorers with just the 3 goals in their 5 games so far. And as Sam's mentioned, yes, their starting 11 on Sunday certainly didn't inspire confidence that they were going to get anything out of their trip to Hiroshima. And indeed, they didn't. So it was very much one-way traffic at the Edion Stadium on Sunday. And, that can absolutely describe the next game we're going to come on to at Tosu on Saturday, where Vissel Kobe were the visitors. And, the visitors just absolutely ran this game from start to finish. There were chances inside the first 10 minutes for Gotoku Sakai and Toya Izumi, and it was the latter who then gave Kobe the lead in the 22nd minute with an absolute stunner for his first J1 goal. The ball was swept out to Izumi on the left-hand touchline. He cut inside his man and from 20 yards curled a remarkable strike into the far top corner. Dare I say, more than a little Mitoma-esque, Sam?
Fair bit. But I don't think Mitoma's necessarily scored a goal as good as this. I mean, it's a lot closer in. Maybe it's like his dribbling is a lot better. But Izumi's finish here was absolutely superb. Just cut inside the defender, who got nowhere near him. And it's a perfect strike into the top corner. Fantastic from him. The first start, I think he's looked good in every game that he's come on. He's been heavily involved off the bench in his first season, which is always a good sign. He looked good in the Louvain Cup as well. And this was a fully justified his start here. It was a magnificent goal. And he's got confidence playing on that left wing. Hopefully he gets a few more games, obviously up against Kuo Yuruki, who was very good last season. It's not going to be easy for him to maintain a position in the first team, but it did his chances no harm here. It was a magnificent display.
Absolutely brilliant goal, yes. And, as I said, it looked like one-way traffic from start to finish. But although they were unable to kill the game off, Kobe, despite Yuya Osako's best efforts, he hit the side netting, and also your header grazed the post in the second half. But, Tosu offered next to nothing throughout this game. And, at this rate, Johnny's concerns about Sagan that he expressed on last week's episode look spot on, Sam. This was absolutely dire from the home side.
Yeah, it really did not look like scoring for the vast majority of this game. I think the only highlight, when I've just gone through and watched them, there was a cross that pushed away by Maikawa. And if that's making your highlight as your only attacking play, then you're in real trouble. Playing Yuji Ono up front, I don't think is good enough. Not really a striker, not really known for being that clinical. So, that's a concern. Maybe when Yokoyama comes back, because obviously he's been away with the Japan under-20s, if he can come in, maybe start. He had a very good record in J3. It's a tough ask to completely demonstrate that again in J1, but that's maybe their biggest hope. But really didn't look like scoring. They didn't create very too much at all. Fuji Honda went off injured midway through the second half, which again doesn't help. But it's just it was disappointing. They really did not test Kobe throughout the 90 minutes.
Yeah, a bit of a horror show from Tosu. The official J-League stats had it to one shot to the hosts to 11 for the visitors. And I know you're curious, listeners. Google has it 2-15. So, whichever source you believe, it was a very, very poor display at home by Tosu on Saturday. And, Kobe now sit alone at the top of the table with the 4 wins from their five games. And, yes, they're rolling along fairly nicely, although, yes, their hosts were particularly accommodating on Saturday. Okay, so the other game that was won on Saturday came at the Nissan Stadium, again in pretty ordinary conditions. Kanto, yes, was hit by a very heavy rain on Saturday. So as we've talked about already, Urawa, and yeah, both of the games in Yokohama were very much weather affected. Yokohama F Marinos hosted traditional rivals Kashima Antlers, and after a goalless first half, this game was sparked into life by a 25-yard first-time thunderbolt from F. Marino's right back, Ken Matsubara, in the 56th minute. Elber's speculative ball into space from the left, met by a perfectly timed run by Matsubara, who lashed an unstoppable drive past Antlers keeper Tomoki Hayakawa. And Matsubara even had his arm raised in celebration before the ball hit the net, Sam. It was tremendous.
Well, yeah, he just caught it so cleanly. He knew as soon as he hit it, it was going in. It was a fantastic strike from him. He's not known for his goals, but I seem to think remember, any time he does score, it seems to be an absolute belter. And this was magnificent. As you said, it sparked the game into life because it wasn't the greatest game. The conditions weren't helping. It was quite bitty. Both teams were quite keen on drawing fouls and complaining and wasting time, it seemed. And yeah, it wasn't the greatest spectacle for the neutral, but this was a fantastic goal. Again, I don't think it was perfect from Elbert. I think he was trying to find Mizunuma with his pass in, but the way it just ran to Matsubara, it was perfect for him to hit, and it was a fantastic strike. And yeah, terrific for him, a terrific moment.
Absolutely. And 6 minutes later, it was a 2-0 to the hosts as the glut of comedy own goals in this young season continued. F. Marino's captain Takuya Kida crossed from the right side of the box, and with no one within 5 yards of him, Antlers defender Keigo Tsunemoto calmly side-footed a volley into his own net from 6 yards out. So it's no Takuya Wada, Sam, but this one is beautiful in its own right, and deserves its own, definitely deserves a nomination in the Own Goal of the Month award. I mean, what on earth was going through Tsunemoto's mind? I mean, if he's trying to clear it, he's got to try and hack it away from goal, surely. But I don't know whether he had a sudden feeling that he was playing striker and he would never score an easier goal, or that's one of the only ways I can describe it.
Yeah, eyes lit up. He's on the score sheet. Little does he know that the J-League will not put him on the score sheet. I don't know what goal it is, but it's just rubbish, wasn't it? I don't know if he thinks he's further behind the far post and thinks he can just knock it to the side, or he's trying to sweep it away and he gets a toe end on it and it doesn't go where he wants. But either way, I think it's so dangerous to try and hook that away right-footed, just aiming towards your goal. I think left-footed, just get it clear wherever it needs to be. That's it was just a really comically casual, the way that he did it, which makes it even worse for him. But yeah, dreadful piece of defending, and yeah, put Kashima really up against it. Just it's hard to really describe it. Just, what are you doing?
Yes, indeed. Remarkable stuff, truly remarkable. But keep them coming, guys. These Own Goals are providing a lot of entertainment for Sam, myself, and of course the wider J-League audience as well, unless of course they happen to happen against your team. But that came 6 minutes after the first goal, and 6 minutes later it was game on again when a determined run down the right from Antlers sub Yuta Matsumura saw him cross into the center, where Yuma Suzuki arrived to power home a shot from close range. Game on, and Suzuki never far away from incidents in a game, Sam, as you say, whether he's trying to draw a foul, get an opponent sent off. But this was a lovely finish at the end of some terrific work down the right by Matsumura.
Yeah, this was the best of Suzuki, and Matsumura, I think, does really well to make the space. It's a really determined run. Once he gets the space, it's a perfect cut back into Suzuki, who gets across his man. Really good movement and a fine finish. So yeah, it was great for Kashima. It looked like they were going to go on and then maybe get back into this game. They'd set themselves up really nicely for the end of the game, but it just didn't quite happen for them. It wasn't, maybe you've got to give credit to Marinos for seeing the game out, but yeah, I just expected a bit more from Racel. I don't expect much from them. I expected more from Antlers at the end of this game. It didn't really materialise because it looked like they'd set themselves up with a nice platform to come back and maybe get a draw from the game.
Yeah, we were hoping for a barnstorming finish, but it didn't come. The only noteworthy thing from the last few minutes of the game was Antlers midfielder Diego Pachuca getting sent off for two yellow cards deep into stoppage time. So, he'd obviously been frustrated throughout, Pachuca, and it all boiled over in second half stoppage time. I mean, obviously easily avoidable. I mean, he doesn't need to have a go at the ref. He doesn't need to clap at the ref for giving him a yellow card in the first place. And then with, a lot of frustration, as I say, boiling over, then he bundles over an F. Marino's man literally right at the death of this game. So an unnecessary couple of yellow cards. And, he'll obviously, it goes without saying, be missing from Antlers' next league fixture. I mean, the referee maybe could exercise a little bit of restraint here at the end of the game. He doesn't need to be sending him off necessarily, but I guess it could be argued that Pachuca didn't give him a choice.
No, I think it just had enough, I think, the referee, because it just been one of those games where it was threatening to boil over for a large periods of it. I think a red card was due, and at this point he just seen that sort of charge. Yeah, it's got to be. I've got to give a red card. I've got to finally stamp my authority on this game. And I don't think Pachuca can have too many complaints. And I don't know, there are rumours that he's been linked with a move to Internacional back in Brazil. So maybe this is the last we see of Pachuca in the league, which would be a shame because he's a much better player than this red card would suggest.
Oh, well, yeah, that would be a real shame because, he's been terrific at times for Antlers, and it would be a shame if, yes, that was his last action in an Antlers kit. But, we'll wait and see what happens over the international break, I suppose. All right, then. So, yeah, it says that three more victories rounded up then. Hiroshima and Kobe both cruising to victories, and a couple of spectacular goals in the F. Marinos Kashima game that was ultimately won by the defending champions by 2-1. Okay, we'll take another quick break, and we'll round up the three draws from J1 Matchday 5 after this. Welcome back, and three draws in J1 match day 5. Yes, back to the pattern of the first three match days. We'll begin our roundup of the final three games at the Panasonic Stadium in Suita, where Gumba Osaka hosted Sapporo, and the English referee, Tom Bramall, was in control of this game, Sam. An interesting cultural exchange here between England and Japan. How did Mr. Bramall fare, did you think?
Yeah, fine. He wasn't noticed, which I think is good for a referee, and no major errors, I don't think. He had a fairly easy game to referee. It wasn't a physical game. It wasn't too many poor challenges in, no VAR controversy in it. So, yeah, he did pretty well, and it was, interesting to see. I remember a few years ago there was like an exchange with Polish referees coming across, so it's nice to see this sort of exchange. I'm not sure I want Mr. Nishimura coming and refereeing a Man United game anytime soon in that exchange, but this worked pretty well.
Okay, that's good to hear. All right, so hopefully more of that later on this season. If it's doable, we'll wait and see. But well done, Mr. Bramall, on a good performance on Saturday. All right, then. So to the game itself, and visiting Sapporo, well, their two goal scorers from last week's terrific win at home over F. Marinos were at it again at the Panasonic Stadium. Yuki Kobayashi getting Consadole off to a flyer in the 6th minute when he lashed in a loose ball via the slightest of deflections off the leg of Gumba midfielder Netta Lavi. And then just past the half hour, Tsuyoshi Ogashiwa raced half the length of the pitch untouched after a dreadful back pass to no one from well inside the Sapporo half by Yuya Fukuda. So, Sapporo looked like they were carrying on the good times from last week's victory. Mind you, very much aided by that horrible error by Fukuda for their second goal.
just rubbish, wasn't it? I don't know who he's aiming for to start with. And then why the two centre-backs split as they see the ball going through the middle of them, I don't know. They just opened it up, kind of welcomed Ogashiwa through. It was just really dreadful defending all around from them. And it was a really poor first half for Gamba. They were all over the place, I thought, defensively. Sapporo with a better side. They again took Darwin out of midfield, and I just don't understand it. He's the one holder in there. He's the one player that protects that defence. They take him out. They conceded four against Kobe. They conceded two in the first half here. It's just, it doesn't really make sense to me, but Sapporo took full advantage of it. They took their goals well when they came. Ogashiwa still has a bit to do as he runs through, but it's a good composed finish past Higashiguchi. And yeah, half time it was looking fantastic for Sapporo. They were on their way to another victory, but this is Sapporo, so they can't have two comfortable victories in a row, surely.
indeed, and so it came to pass. So yeah, 11 minutes into the second half, a double change by Gamba manager Danny Poyatos helped swing the fortunes of this game. As Sam's mentioned, Darwin was dropped / rested from the start of this game, but yes, he came on alongside Hideki Ishige 11 minutes into the second half, and yes, within 5 minutes of those two players coming on, Gamba were level. First, Ishige side-footed in his first J1 goal in 5 years after a brilliant first-time through ball from Lavi sent to New Japan national team squad member Riku Honda away down the right, and he squared for Ishige to tap in. Then 2 minutes later, a lovely ball in from the left by Keisuke Kurokawa was played back across goal by Naohiro Sugiyama, with Juan Alano arriving to side foot home the equaliser. So, I don't know, the Midas touch here from Poyatos, Sam. As you said, you were surprised to see Darwin dropped and, having to come off the bench to make any sort of a difference. But it's a good redemption story for Ishige, isn't it? So long without a top flight goal. And, he played a huge part in Gamba turning this game around.
Yeah, really nice to see. I'm always happy when Ishige does well because he's battled so many injuries throughout his career. So he had a decent purple patch, I think, last season for them. It's been a while since that's been the case here. But yeah, he did really well. Great immediate impact. And give credit to him. Give credit to Poyatos, who made the changes. I thought Gamba then switched up the way they were playing a lot more. They were a bit more direct, a little bit more quick with their passes. They went forward, used the wings really well. And when you saw Handa and Kurokawa in the same team, that's what you expect. It's their bombing wing backs, yeah, creating chances, and both did here. The two goals are really well taken, really really well crafted. And you have to mention the pass from Neto Lavi for the first goal. It's not an easy ball that comes to him. It's still off the floor. Beautiful ball into that right inside right channel to Handa, just perfectly weighted for him to set up Ishige. And likewise, the pass from Kurokawa was really good, and it was a great response from Gamba. They wish they could get the monkey off the back and get the first victory because they had all the momentum, but then just couldn't get themselves over the line. There's still the draw curse on Poyatos, but the second half at least was a step in the right direction, a much better performance.
Indeed, yes, they had to turn it around, and yeah, those changes certainly helped them do that. But Gamba still looking for their first victory of the new season after, this was their third draw of the campaign, while Sapporo sit in 11th, and they've also played three draws so far this season. All right, I think we should mention before we leave this game, though, Sam, a vital intervention by the Gamba keeper, Masaaki Higashiguchi, to deny Taika Nakashima winning Sapporo all 3 points in the 94th minute because, as you say, yeah, Gamba had all the momentum on their side after those two goals saw them equalise just past the hour. But, if it wasn't for Higashiguchi, then everybody would have gone home from the Panasonic Stadium disappointed.
Yeah, really good save from him. A good redemption from last week, which was that horror show at the end. But yeah, vital save here. And I think, again, I'll give credit to Poyatos. Although I wouldn't have made the change in the first place, at least he didn't panic and then immediately make the change back after Higashiguchi's error last week. And yeah, he repaid that faith for this vital save here. It was Nakashima, maybe if he played a little bit more football, a little bit sharper, he'd have got the ball out of his feet better before prodding forward. But still, very good save from Higashiguchi. And that would have been a cruel blow on Gamba if they'd have conceded so late on.
Absolutely. All right, so the last two games finished goalless. We'll kick these two off by moving to Todoroki, where Kawasaki hosted Cerezo Osaka. Two early chances for the hosts. Chanatip, in just the second minute, drew a low save from Kim Jin-hyun, and then 11 minutes later, Akihiro Iyanaga curled just over from the edge of the box. But the better chances for the remainder of the first half went to the visitors. In the 18th minute, Mutsuki Kato headed wastefully over when Ryosuke Yamanaka found him completely unmarked in the center. Then 7 minutes before the break, another superb ball in from the left by Yamanaka was stabbed wide by Seiya Maekuma, who couldn't quite sort his feet out. Now, the game remained goalless until very, very late on, Sam. And as well, obviously, as we know, it finished goalless at the end of the day. And it's very, very late in the episode to play the drop. And, well, technically, Kawasaki's 92nd minute goal, in inverted commas, not being allowed to stand, didn't even qualify to be checked by VAR, I believe. But it's a massive cock-up from the linesman and referee, and we've got to play it. So,
this week in VAR. This week in VAR. This week.
Yeah, it's just a dreadful piece of refereeing, really. Noborizato had it on the left wing, plays it through to Yu Kobayashi. He's the where the offside is judged from, but yeah, he's onside. Play continues, he plays it. He has a shot, it's deflected up to Sagawa. He hooks it back, hits the crossbar, comes to Iyanaga. He fires it across to Miyashiro, and just as Miyashiro is about to score, and he does put the ball in the net, the referee blows his whistle for offside. It is rubbish refereeing. You should not do that. You have to play it on, especially as they're about to score, because VAR cannot overturn it once he calls the play dead. And he calls the play dead before the ball goes into the net, so they can't review the offside call, which turns out to be wrong. It's so poor, this refereeing, and Kawasaki are denied a clear winner there. It was awful refereeing, but there's nothing that the VAR system can do because the referee is not refereed it properly. I haven't seen an official apology from the J-League today, but I think one might be coming, because this is just a poor application of the rules. You have to play on. I know people complain about like flags going up late or not being flagged once they allow play to continue, but they have to allow it to continue. And in no circumstances should you be really calling this dead in the six-yard box as Kawasaki are about to shoot, unless there's been an absolute clear foul. He shouldn't be getting involved. So I don't know why he takes matters into his own hands. It was really confusing. And yeah, Kawasaki have every right to be frustrated at this.
Yeah, it's really, really poor, isn't it? And yeah, as you say, yeah, and I'm sure an official apology will be on its way for obviously the second time this season after the injustice suffered by Hiroshima in match day one. And, you know, I mean, if this happens in the, you know, the 45th minute, 65th minute, even the 75th minute, you can say, OK, well, it hasn't necessarily cost Frontale 3 points because, you know, a butterfly flapping its wings, etc., etc. But I mean, yes, this was literally in the 92nd minute. And okay, if the goal had have been allowed to stand, could Cerezo have gone up the other end and equalized? Well, yes, they could have. But for all intents and purposes, yes, this has cost Kawasaki 2 points, just as Hiroshima were robbed of 2 points against Sapporo back in match day one. So it's it's absolutely dreadful. And I mean, yeah, your point about people complaining about late flags or not flagging until a play is officially dead. Sometimes that gets people's backs up. But this is a perfect indication of why it is done that way. And this is just a horrendous cock up by the officials in this game. And it wasn't the greatest spectacle, was it, Sam? But I mean, there were decent chances at either end. Jung was impressive for Kawasaki when he was called upon, and obviously I mentioned that early save from Kim to deny Chanatip, and he was he stood up strong throughout the game as well. So as nil nils go, and we're going to come on to talk about one of the poorest ones you'd ever wish to see. I don't think this was the worst game that we've ever seen, was it?
No, it was a reasonable one. Both teams tried to create chances. I don't think Kawasaki still are anywhere near their best, but they did create a few opportunities. I think some of the best ones, as you mentioned, came for Cerezo. I thought Kato's header in the 18th minute was so poor. It was just no conviction on it at all after a perfect cross in from Yamanaka. And yeah, Jung made a couple of decent saves. Maekuma had a couple of chances, but yeah, one flicked wide, one well saved. And then I have to be fair, there was a call for handball and a penalty for Cerezo about 5 minutes from time, I think it was. Ominami goes to clear it and completely misses it. And as it misses it, it hits his arm. It's down by his side. And I can understand that. I think it's in a natural position. I don't think he's gaining necessarily an advantage from the ball hitting his hand because he just completely messed his clearance up. So I can understand why he wasn't given a not and on referral wasn't changed. But yeah, also can understand Cerezo supporters being quite upset about this. It might be one where if it was given on the field, it wouldn't have been overturned. But so it's one of those which could have gone either way. And this time didn't go Cerezo's way. But I think they've probably earned that back with the mistake at the other end from the referee.
Yeah, all right then. So not all nil-nil draws were created equal. There was, a number of talking points and obviously one for negative reasons at the end of the Frontale-Cerezo game. While at the Toyota Stadium in Aichi Prefecture, Nagoya hosted FC Tokyo and 90 minutes of football were played, allegedly, no goals to show and a real shortage of goal mouth action in this game. I guess we come to expect that from a Nagoya defense that is as miserly as ever this season. They've allowed just one goal through their first five games, and from an FC Tokyo perspective, they have needed to be tighter at the back. So the fact that they were able to keep a front line of Kasper Juncker, Kensuke Nagai and Mateus out, I guess, is a positive. But my mate Graham went down for a cheeky away day, Sam, and while I'm sure he enjoyed the sights and sounds of Nagoya, yes, the 90 minutes he was inside the Toyota Stadium, I bet he wish he could have back because, this was not much to write home about.
No, it wasn't. I'm going to get your opinion on this because Tokyo changed their system to just match up against Nagoya. And they kind of went away from the way that Albert Pucci is kind of wanting this team to play with the way he presents Tokyo and the way that they are playing football. Is this just a situation you think where it's right to go to Nagoya and to hold out for that 0-0 draw and that's a really good result? Or do you expect your team, especially the way the manager has been and the way he's been presenting the team, do you think that you should have stuck to your guns, sort of stuck to trying to play that way and go for a victory? Because it just seemed like you were there to nullify Nagoya and take the point.
Yeah, I was surprised by it, I must admit. Kimoto, Trevisan and Morishige all in the team. I don't know if we saw that at all last season, or if we did, it might have been when there were injuries in midfield. But yeah, it did take me by surprise. I would imagine if Kuryu Matsuki was back from the under-20s in time, then he would have started this game and then it would have been rejigged slightly. But I'm slightly surprised to see him take Tokyo there to try and just cancel Nagoya out. Although it might be an indication that he's trying to be a little bit more flexible and play a little bit of horses for courses here, because we know how dangerous Grampus can be up front. So if he's trying to get Tokyo with a little bit more backbone ahead of an away game like this, then I guess I can see the reasoning behind it. But as I say, it did take me by surprise, and I guess it blunted Tokyo's attacking threat, as you would imagine it would do, with only really Diego Oliveira and Teruhito Nakagawa out and out attackers in the starting 11. But it'll be interesting to see how he does going forward, especially in other away games against prospective top six rivals, because I wonder if this was just horses for courses and not necessarily a philosophical change.
Yeah, it's interesting because I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to go against a team with a front three as like Nagoya and a difficult away game and set up for a point and maybe try and counter. It's a fair way of going. It's just it seemed a departure from the way that he's been at Tokyo. It seems like he wants to play this progressive football and he'd do it against anyone. And to step away from that, it just surprised me. And yeah, it'd be interesting if it is just for this one game or if it's going to be a thing. He's just thought, I need to adjust my tactics a little bit for certain games and, yeah, maybe stiffen the backbone up a little bit for Tokyo, and came away with a clean sheet, which is a positive, I'm sure. And wasn't a great game for Tokyo. Didn't see anything of them really going forward, and the chances did fall to Nagoya. And on another day, Mateus might have had his shooting boots on. They might have come away with the victory themselves. So it was just, yeah, it was just interesting. It was it was just a move I didn't expect from Albert Pucci.
Yeah, same. Well, as I said, yeah, same. I was surprised when I saw the lineup, but again, with expecting to have Matsky back after the international break, then yeah, this might have just been a one-off, but we will wait and see. All right, then. So yeah, Sam's mentioned it. Mateus on another day might have had a couple of goals. Probably the best two chances of the game came to the Brazilian 4 minutes before the break. Kasper Juncker slipped him in, but he fired into the side netting. And then in the 78th minute, he cut inside Masato Morishige, and with just Jakub Slovic to beat, Mateus basically shot straight into the keeper's arms. And that was, yeah, basically the last of the big chances in the game as it ended goalless. All right, so that's all nine games rounded up then. And before match day six rolls around, of course, we've got the Japan national team in action in a couple of friendlies. Firstly, against Uruguay at the National Stadium in Tokyo on Friday the 24th. And then, 4 days later, the Samurai Blue will head to the Yodoko Sakura Stadium in Osaka, the home of Cerezo, for a clash against Colombia. So at the end of last week, Hajime Moriyasu named a squad of 26 players. There are 16 World Cup squad members amongst them and four first timers, although one of them has already pulled out due to injury. That is the Yokohama F. Marinos central defender Ryotaro Tsunoda. He was replaced earlier Monday, I believe, by Haruya Fuji of Nagoya. While of course one of the bigger names in the squad and a guaranteed starter for Japan, Takehiro Tomiyasu, is of course out, and we believe now out for the remainder of the Premier League season. And he has been replaced in the squad by Koki Machida of Union Saint-Gilloise. So, Sam, yes, the other three first-timers, Riku Honda, who we've mentioned earlier from Gumba Osaka, the exciting right-back, Kashif Bangunagande from FC Tokyo, a new face in the squad at left-back, and Keito Nakamura getting a chance as well. So, yes, how did you take those three inclusions?
Yeah, all very interesting. It's an interesting squad, and a lot of the young players he's brought in have ones like seen like with a view for 4 years down the line, or three and a half, or however long it is until the next World Cup. And I like that. These are friendlies. This is the time to blood these young players in. So I really liked it. I think Nakamura has done really well in Austria. I think he's deserving of his call up. Absolutely. I think the goals he scored, is a lot of teams, as I said last week, are looking at him for a potential move in the summer. So yeah, it was good to see him recognised. And then with Handra at right back, I think he's always one that has been seen for a while as going to be a future right back for Japan, and for him to get in gives him a chance. I think it's really good if we can see him play like he did at the weekend. I think that's fantastic. And then left back was the big one, because we didn't really know where they were going to go with that. They've not been great options at left back. And Bangunagande, at the moment, I don't think he's completely ready. I don't think he's necessarily ready. But the only way you get him ready is by playing games. And I think to get him in and around the squad, I think, is going to be great for him. I think he's definitely got the potential to be the future left back for Japan. So, yeah, good on him. I think it was maybe between him and Nagato, I thought, for that position. And generally, when there's been questions like that, and he's definitely gone with the younger players, which I think is good. Like, Nagato is 28. Maybe he just doesn't see him necessarily as there for the World Cup, and he wants to start with a younger player. So that's fair enough to me. And I think, yeah, Bangunagande, it's going to do the world of good to be in and around this squad for the next two games. I'm sure you're delighted for him as an FC Tokyo supporter.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've said a couple of times in the last couple of weeks, I'm not sure if he's ready or if he's ever going to be at that level. But yeah, as you say, there's only one way to find out. And yeah, it's a terrific opportunity for him, and wrapped for him. As I said, he went off against Yokohama FC in the previous league game, and I was wondering whether he was going to even be in the frame for selection. But yes, he did play on Saturday at Nagoya, and after getting the nod for this squad. So terrific for him. Other noteworthy elements of the squad, Sam, in goal, I guess it probably went as we expected, with the Daniel Schmidt now the incumbent after Shuichi Gonda was not considered due to his playing in J2 now. And the next cabs off the rank, Keisuke Osako from Sanfrecce Hiroshima, and Kosei Tani, even though he's lost his spot for the last couple of games to Masaaki Higashiguchi, he was always likely to be taken as well. So I guess not really too many surprises between the sticks.
Not really. They've always been next in line, so you can understand why it's there. I would have gone Kosuke Nakamura. I think he's having a fantastic season in Portugal. Yeah, starter there, he's really established himself, and I thought, yeah, this was his opportunity. But yeah, he's gone with Osako Tani. Again, it's one of those decisions. Did he go with the 28-year-old Nakamura or the 22-year-old Tani? He's gone younger, and that's fair enough, I think. Maybe Nakamura's time has unfortunately gone for him. I hope not. I hope he can force his way into the team. But yeah, I'm not going to necessarily argue too much whenever he goes for a younger player, because this squad, especially defensively and in goal, seems to be building for the future. And I can't have too many complaints about that.
Yeah, fair enough then. And it's finally happened. Eiji Kawashima is now seemingly forever out of the national team picture. So a big Otsukare-sama to Kawashima for all his exertions over the past, 25 years or something like that, Sam? He's been there seemingly for forever. But it looks like it's finally his race has been run. Also notable, of course, that Yuto Nagatomo was not named in this squad. And in midfield / forward, as Moriyasu continues to annoy me with, there's no Gaku Shibasaki finally.
Yeah, amazingly. Delighted by that. I'm not necessarily against Shibasaki, but I don't think he's good enough. He's now 30. I don't think the future is of Japan's midfield is with Shibasaki in. So yeah, I think that was a good decision. Generally he's dropped a lot of the older players. Nagatomo, as you mentioned, Sakai not in this squad, Yoshida not in. I think this is just temporary with Yoshida, but I think it's a better move. Taniguchi as well missed out. So yeah, a lot of those older players moved on for this round of fixtures at least. The other big talking point in midfield is Hatate not in the squad. We thought played really well for Celtic, but yeah, Moriyasu came out firing against the Scottish League and wasn't saying a great deal of positive words about that. And it brings an interesting decision for Hatate and for Furuhashi, who both weren't in it. And do they feel the need to leave Celtic? Do they feel the need to go into a more high-profile league to catch the Moriyasu's IMB in this national team? Or do you stay at Celtic? You've still got the Champions League and you can prove yourself in that. So it's a really interesting conundrum for those teams. And it was a question I posed to, I work with a YouTube channel called 67 Hail Hail, who was Celtic. I've spoken about a lot of the players going to Celtic on their channel, and I asked him, is it a concern for them, the link between Celtic and Japan? Are Japanese players now going to be less likely to choose Celtic as their destination because it seems to hamper their move into the national team? Obviously Tomoki Iwata didn't make it here, Maeda did, but he's previously played for Moriyasu. He seems to be trusted in that position. I think he's got credit in the bank, whereas Furuhashi and Hatate don't. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see that relationship and how that develops. Obviously this is just one squad, they might come into it later, they might come into the reckoning. But yeah, it's a really, especially Furuhashi, because with the greatest respect to the other players in that, like Asano still making it, Maida's not as good a striker, Machino is decent J-League level, but is the J-League that much better than Scotland? I don't think it is really. So if you're judging it on levels, that's a weird decision to make. So I think those are, they'll be simmering sagas, I think, throughout every squad. But yeah, is there anything else that took your eye in this squad? Anyone else that maybe, like Minamino not making it, for example?
Yeah, I mean, he's he's obviously moved on from Liverpool, but it's someone I still keep an eye on. But yeah, I don't really think he can have too many complaints, and this might be a proper turning of the page by Moriyasu on a number of players. And Minamino, I think, will ultimately end up being one of those. Again, I don't think the door is closed on him, but I think he had to get out of Liverpool to play more regularly, but Monaco hasn't worked out for him either. So whether he needs to move on again in the next closed season and try and get actual proper regular football to maybe get himself back into Moriyasu's thoughts. But I think a number of players have gone past him, and he might be yesterday's man already. Minamino, the fact that even like a Takuma Nishimura, there's nobody batting an eyelid over the fact that he's in this squad and Minamino isn't. I mean, he's absolutely there on merit, Nishimura, for the way he's done it at F Marino. So, I think just as an overall summary of the squad, a changing of the guard perhaps, or a number of the more experienced players being phased out. And again, as you said with Yoshida, it might not be for the final time, but a number of them it might be. And the Scottish situation is definitely one to watch as well. I mean, just out of interest, is a Celtic fan actually happy that Hatate and Furuhashi aren't going away for two friendlies with about 2 months to go in the season? I imagine that they're pretty happy that they'll be staying in Glasgow and wrapped in cotton wool.
Yeah, it seemed like short-term happiness, long-term bit of concern. And Hatate got himself injured, actually, at the weekend, so he would have been pulling out, which would have been a nightmare for him if he'd finally got a breakthrough and then had to pull out. So, he will be wrapped in cotton wool anyway, and they're happy for the short term as they're still fighting for a couple of trophies that, to keep them under wraps is good, but really you want your players to be able to go to the national team, to be able to play at the highest level. And it is a concern, I think, for those sort of supporters that they're not making it. And you just worry, like, especially with the Premier League down below, and you see that, like, players are now playing well. Mitoma has obviously done so well this season for Brighton. It just do Hatate look. And Furuhashi, do they look at the Premier League and think, well, maybe we'll go there, more exposure in that league? There's no way Moriyasu could say the Premier League is not a strong and competitive league. And they might look to go there to get into the national team. So, I think that it sounded like there was some concern from Celtic supporters. But for the meantime, for this window at least, they're quite happy that they're not going.
Right, fair enough then. And just one final thing. I mean, one of the first time call ups was Tsunoda from F Marinos. It certainly would have been one to warm Scott McIntyre's heart. I'm sure he was right on to Tsunoda as one to watch last season. So it's just a shame that he won't be able to make it after seemingly picking up an injury against Kashima on the weekend. But he's one to watch. And I mean, the two players that have come in to replace Tomiyasu and Tsunoda are also first-time call-ups in Machida and Fuji. So I guess overall, how pleased are you with Tsunoda especially getting the call? And as I say, he won't be able to play in these two games, but he's definitely now, we can tell he's in Moriyasu's thoughts going forward.
Yeah, it's great that he's on the radar. It is a real shame he's missed out, because with Tomiyasu going out injured, there was a chance that he started a couple of these games, well, one of these games at least. Real shame that he's out, but I think... yeah, it's great that Moriyasu has him, and I think he should be able to develop into that left-sided centre-back for Japan. I think he's had a very good start to the season, defensively very, very solid, and added that because he was always very good passing out, and his ability to progress the ball from that position. So I think he'll be a valuable asset to Japan in the future. And the call-ups afterwards are quite interesting. Koki Machida has had a long time out injured. He's playing at a team top of, I think they're top of the Belgian league, but he's not really first choice there. So it wasn't like an immediate thought that he would be the next up. I still think Araki is maybe unfortunate not to have this position over Machida. But the other one, Haruya Fuji, who has just come on leaps and bounds in the last season a bit at Nagoya, established himself quite firmly as first choice there and knocking Maruyama out of the team on a couple of occasions this season. So, I think it's a great one for him. Another one, a bit like Banganagando, I think maybe he's not quite ready at the moment, but this exposure should really help him. So, I have no real qualms about the two decisions, but I thought maybe Araki was unlucky.
All right, then. Okay, so, yeah, Japan will face Uruguay and Colombia over the international break. And, well, Sam and I haven't actually thrashed this out in the green room, but I imagine we'll be recording after the Colombia game on Tuesday of next week. So next week's episode of J-Talk will be out a day later than usual. But, yeah, we'll be wrapping up those two national team games and looking forward to the return of J1. So, yes, maybe we could have less of the comedy officiating, but more of the calamitous own goals are going forward, Sam. I think that would be a nice balance to strike.
Yeah, absolutely. Starting with Sebastian Coates on Friday, please.
Yeah, indeed. There's a blast from the past. Absolutely. All right, then. Okay, so we'll leave it there. That's it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. Sam and I would like to thank all of our patrons for their ongoing support on Patreon. If you'd like to get involved, please visit patreon.com/JTalkPod. And listeners, we'd like to thank you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to round up Japan's two friendlies. Speak to you then. Bye for now.
The J-Talk Podcast. Yes, 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 yes.